You're listening to a free show on WrestlingObserver.com, the leaders in news and inside information on both professional wrestling and mixed martial arts. To learn how to subscribe and get immediate access to hundreds of past newsletters written by Dave Meltzer and Brian Alvarez, as well as thousands of hours of podcasts and interviews, go to bit.ly/JNPO subscribe. That's bit.ly/JNPO subscribe. Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 37 of Josh Nason's Punch Out. I'm Josh Nason, writer, editor, podcaster, assistant web editor for WrestlingObserver.com. Welcome back. Fun episode on tap today. I feel like I should have talked to someone from the Wall Street Journal, given all the news coming about the UFC and potential sales, partial sales, all that stuff. So we talked about numbers, but a different type of numbers. And we talked to jump into the world of analytics, sports analytics, hot topic right now across any sport you talk about. It's got its detractors. It's got its, protagonists. It's got its supporters. MMA, it's really kind of like an early art, and a lot of people aren't doing it, but I did find one of the guys that is. His name is Reed Kuhn. I'm sure you've heard of him, probably by his moniker, Fightnomics. He is, we talked for about almost an hour, a great guy. We talked about all types of cool stuff. He is he's doing some cool stuff for ESPN Insider that we got into. We talk a little bit about kind of just, you know, for the first timers, for the early adopters for this MMA, for analytics in mixed martial arts, what type of stuff should you be looking for? How is it difficult for this generation of fighters and managers and agents and so on that we have right now? How difficult is it for them to grasp all the data that's coming at them? And we talk a lot about the importance of intermediaries and just all kinds of types of cool stuff. If you're in mixed martial arts analytics, or if you're in analytics or any sport, trying to understand kind of how all this stuff works, I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. We do talk a little bit about, obviously, UFC 198 coming this weekend, and we lead off talking for about 10 minutes or so on the potential sale of the UFC, partial sale of the UFC, all that good stuff. So we kind of fanboy out about that for a few minutes, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. So without further ado, enjoy Reed Kuhn from Fightnomics, and I'll see you after the interview. In a 24-hour stretch where a lot of big numbers are being thrown around, it seemed fitting to have a man on that lives by the numbers, just a different kind. Known at one point as the fight scientist, our guest holds a bachelor's degree in physics from Washington and Lee University, a master's degree in systems engineering from the University of Virginia, and an MBA from the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University. Hopefully I pronounced that right. He began his career analyzing MMA back in 2009 in a research fellowship with Fightmetric. He's parlayed that into a pretty great reputation as an analyst overall. He's the author of Fightnomics, The Hidden Numbers and Science of Mixed Martial Arts, and he is this week's guest on Josh Nason's Punch-Out. We welcome Reed Kuhn to the show. And Reed, I always like to start out with the high heat, the toughest question, the stuff that makes you sweat. Has a group of Chinese businessmen ever offered you a boatload of money?
No, not yet. And I'm still waiting. I would not be close to that conversation.
I had a group of Japanese businessmen offer me money for a night way back in the day, but that's for a different podcast. But before we get into obviously everything that's going on with you, the book, analyzing things, just this whole world, which I think you've really just kind of intersected with at the perfect time with the sport. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the past 24 hours or so as we record this on Wednesday afternoon, even less than 24 hours. Last night, kind of a rumor that a lot of people had heard for quite some time that the UFC was entertaining the sale of their organization to somebody, a group. And a lot of it was just kind of, you heard about these investment groups overseas, venture capitalists, and so on and so forth. Would they sell it? Just, they weren't really saying anything about it because no one really had a concrete story. last night, ESPN.com, Darren Revelle published basically the first, you know, main story on this, and cited some sources, talked about these various groups. And kind of where we're at right now is UFC has denied a full sale. However, they have said that they've kind of alluded to something going on there, and a lot of people seem to surmise that as being some sort of investment instead of an overall sale. Of course, with promoters, you don't really know because of the nature of the business and also disclosures and all this stuff. As we sit here on Wednesday afternoon, what are you making of what we heard about so far since last night with this whole sale?
It's definitely surprising, but I think it was something a lot of us have been waiting for a long time. You know, the number of headaches in running a $4 billion valued company versus running one at $2 million where it's more of a traveling circus, it's just astronomically different. And the guys who walked into this, they wanted to see it become what it has become today, but certainly all the headaches that come along with that, regulatory issues, just think of all the drug testing things that have been coming up. These are so many headaches that were not even on their radar 10 years ago or 15 years ago that are now defining their day-to-day existence. And so, you know, this was bought by these guys. They had a blast doing it early on. It definitely had a small family feel to it. And even events just in the last 5 years, I would say, have changed pre and post Fox World. So I'm not really surprised. Again, it's still early. We have no idea how real this is, how far along they are. Are they just in talks to maybe invest in a joint venture that would launch something that was more internationally focused and then retain the core UFC here at home? Who knows? But the fact that they're open to investment is not surprising. They should be. They should always be open to talking to interested parties that have the money and that are serious about this. And the names that are being thrown around are very serious players. So I'm excited to see what develops, because just seeing the UFC get bought and the old way going away and this becoming a truly mainstream sport under more commercial management, I don't know if that's really going to happen in the near term. Dana White's not going anywhere. Any deal that is done is going to be sure to keep key players involved for as long as they can. So I'm wondering if maybe there's more of an international angle to this that could be, you know, the UFC getting really serious about international expansion, because that is something that would really pump up their valuation.
It was interesting. One of the many things that's interesting about this this whole situation is, you know, what people thinking, a lot of the jumping conclusions that happens in social media these days, and just based on people's backgrounds and people's kind of what they've done, what they know, the assumption that, you know, that if a company was to come in and say buy the UFC outright, say we're going to go with that angle, that all of a sudden they would just disrupt everything, fire everyone, and completely remake it in their image. I think people kind of aren't realizing that people, successful companies like the ones that are on this list, they're not going to pay $3 to $4 billion just to simply disrupt exactly why they're paying $3 to $4 billion for this organization. And you're right. I can't see Dana White going anywhere. If that was to happen, I could see obviously the Fertittas, because it wouldn't be owners, and really their primary role seems to be ownership, some contract negotiation, but you would think they would obviously step aside for that. But Dana White being a figurehead, some sort of taking care of some contract negotiations, other things like that. I think he's going to stay around. But to me, you know, people worried, and I get how people would be worried if a outright sale would happen. But I think there's plenty of cases over history with sports organizations, with teams, and so on, where sales have been good, and often, you know, and ends up making the organization better. It's just an investment. I think for a lot of these groups, they're looking for an investment, and if they have the money and they think this is good and they think they can make money in it, continually over time, it would seem to make sense. But I think people worrying about, you know, complete disruption if something was to happen with a full sale, I think they have to kind of be patient, let this thing play out a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And just think all the natural due diligence that would go into something of this size. I mean, they're bringing in huge teams of bankers and consultants to to really pin down that valuation, what that number is going to be. You know, the difference between $3.5 billion and $4 billion sounds like a few decimal points, but it's a hell of a lot of money, and it's very material to these organizations. So one of the key things they have to identify is where can we actually add value? Do we believe that we can take what the UFC has built and actually make it better and more successful? And then what are the risks that stand in our way? And one of those huge risks is, what if existing key players, the important man clause, what if this guy walks out the door? What happens? And what about all the people behind Dana White? I mean, there are key people that have been there since the beginning, like Joe Silva, who on paper, he's a matchmaker, but he's also the vice president of fighter management or fighter relations. I can't remember the formal title. There's Ratner, you know, he's deeply involved in regulatory issues. He's been behind the huge fight to get legalized in New York. There's a whole lineup of guys that have been around for the last decade that are not in the news all the time. And any of them is instrumental to ensuring that the process continues, that the ops continues. So that whole operations team that has been around, that has perfected the ability to put on an MMA event like every week, sometimes multiple times a weekend, and actually pull it off. And then on the production side, same thing. So there's an army of people that have perfected this over a long period of time. And anyone coming in with money that's going to buy this organization has to believe that they can ensure that those things stay in place, and they can believe that additional money would actually make it better. You know, really rolling this out in Asia, for example, where there's bigger growth potential than here at home or in Western Europe anyway, that would probably be a big justification. So it's going to be someone who thinks they can actually pull that off.
Yeah. You kind of spin to like, why would they be looking to sell? Is there some sort of and I think people forget, like, you know, Fertitta's are businessmen, and they may have other interests. It could be, if it's not this, you know, NFL thing that people seem to be jumping to conclusions on, maybe there's other stuff that they simply want to do in sports. Maybe it's they want to be part of a brand new stadium build in Vegas or something like that. Perhaps they want to do some other stuff, and they've had this $2 million investment that is now worth, you know, depending on who you ask, and if these numbers are right, several billion dollars. You know, if the outright sale, that makes a lot of sense. But also, if it's a partial investment, yeah, what are they looking to accomplish with that? And you mentioned, you know, expansion to Asia. I think maybe it being a little bit more of a force there, as opposed to just kind of a small organization that has these kind of blips on the radar. I think sometimes because we don't really understand overseas business as much as others, maybe we tend to forget that it takes a lot to get into these places. And that's, you know, one of the reasons that when Flash bought that 10%, it was seen that perhaps they were trying to expand in those areas. And the only way they could do that was to use kind of these other organizations to help kind of pave the way. Yeah. It's a really interesting time. And is there one glaring thing that you would see aspect of this whole thing that you would see that this money could help with? Is it simply the expansion to Asia, or is there something else you would like to see them do if they were to get a big infusion of capital?
Some of the risk aversion, I think, you know, UFC has innovated a lot of things, and they're at a point now where they also don't want to screw anything up. You know, they're sitting on a very tightly run operation, and it's now up to the other promotions, such as Bellator, to push the envelope in terms of the bells and the whistles. You know, the Bellator shows are pushing the envelope more so on live production, lots of lights and effects and digital things. And eventually I would like to see far more detailed data collection in the cage. So, you know, sensors on gloves and monitoring of the athletes that not only helps the regulation side of things, you know, to monitor how much damage they've taken, and it also improves their ability to train effectively and improve there. But it also allows the fans much, much greater insight into what's happening. So in all other sports, we have numbers, we have statistics, we have live stats that are very detailed, and they enhance the viewer experience. And the UFC has slowly adopted statistics, and they've come up the curve well in terms of broadcast and also outside of analysis, you know, pre and post. What they haven't really done is really go for it in the cage and during the fight, so that we can have far greater insight into what's happening with each athlete. So that's something that we are getting into in other sports. We're starting to know how far each soccer player has run on the field by halftime, and therefore who might be more tired. We have every pitch with number of the miles per hour on it. Well, just imagine seeing every punch recorded in terms of how hard it was and how much damage a guy's taken. That stuff is going to be, I think, very interesting as a next gen thing. But you have to have not only the capital to invest and build that, you also need to have the security to take those risks. And right now, I think the UFC is sitting on such a good, valuable thing. They probably don't want to take too much risk at the moment. They've already taken a ton of risk getting it to this point. Now, actually, other people are going to be chomping at the bit to see if they can carve out a piece by doing something different than the way the UFC does it.
That's a great segue to kind of opening up the conversation about what you bring to the table and what you've seen over the years. Before we get into that, where do you see analytics in the fight game in 2016? Obviously, it's improved. It improves with technology and the willingness of organizations and fighters to kind of be part of the process. But as we, I mentioned during the open back in 2009, kind of your formal introduction getting into this in more of a public forum, I guess you could say. And then all this time later, you've written a book and everything. Where do you kind of see the game of analytics and such in the sport in 2016?
Well, the first big step is that you have to actually collect the data before you can do anything with it. And so that is something that Fightmetric innovated from scratch years ago, back in 2008, 2009. And someone had to go through that process. And that's actually a very difficult process, is to look at something chaotic like a cage fight and then make sense of it to the point where you can actually repeatably and accurately record everything that happened and have it make sense. So that is the real magic that they brought to the sport. And obviously they were very successful in doing it. The UFC partnered with them. ESPN has partnered with them. Everybody uses them as the single source of truth for what happens in a fight. So now that we have this data and we have it over time, you can actually start to analyze it and tease out what are the macro trends, what are the micro trends that are specific to individual fighters. And that's where things get interesting, and for a variety of reasons. So there's all these different stakeholders. There's athletes themselves, there's fans, there's trainers and managers. And then there's the sport. There's the oversight, the UFC, as well as the sports commissions. So there's a lot of end users that could be using this data. I think to some extent, all of them are. But I think where most people see the numbers is on TV, bite-sized statistics about where people rank all time or in their division in a particular metric. And it's somewhat of a limited use. It's definitely used in other sports. We talk about, if we're watching Peyton Manning, it's all about, is he going to break a certain record and when does he eclipse a career milestone? We have those in MMA too, and those are just general rankings. But what's interesting is, far more specific performance metrics. What truly differentiates one fighter from another, and how can that inform the viewer in terms of what might happen in a fight, or what is interesting that is happening in this fight that is unusual in some way? So I think we can do a lot more. So the short answer is that we've come a long way in creating the data. We're still dipping our toes in the water when it comes to using it to its full potential. But all the different stakeholders that are involved, I think they're starting to understand that there's a resource here. And I've seen, a difference over the years in terms of the adoption. So showing this stuff to a fighter or a manager or a coach, there's definitely a different response in 2016 than there was in 2009.
And I think you hit on a good point. And I think everyone that's ever that works for a service provider in any walk of life and that has to give monthly reports, weekly reports, analytical data, you can simply give this whole data dump to people, but there has to be some sort of intermediary to understand, help understand, especially what does it mean, right? And more than ever, in every walk of life, there is more and more and more data, but there's more and more and more questions about what can I do with this? Is it useful? And so on. I think that's going to be a big thing going forward, is finding these intermediaries, and obviously you're one of them, and I'm sure there's others that we're going to hear from over time that can help these fighters, organization camps understand this is what this means when this happens, we think, based on all the numbers we're telling that they're telling us. And I think we're seeing that across sports in general, is that, you know, and I want to get to more about that in a minute, but I think with a fight game, because you have such individual personalities, and maybe managers or trainers may be concerned about, okay, I don't want to tell my fighter that their punch velocity or the punch impact is down, because then they may start swinging harder, and then this they may do this instead, and blah, blah, blah. So I sense that we're still a ways away from really kind of figuring out how to communicate that. But that's obviously an important thing going forward, is having people be able to make sense of all this data and then be able to say, this is what you can take away from this, and then choose on how to enact a game plan, I guess, from there.
Yeah, exactly. I think you bring up a good example, is how do people interpret this, and how might they be inclined to misinterpret it? And so if they look at too much information, they just throw it off to the side and say, it's too overwhelming, I don't know what to take from this. Whereas if you latch onto one thing and you might conclude something and then it backfires or something like that, you conclude that, well, this led me astray. The data should always be there as a resource. How you use it is obviously, there's a million different ways to go there. But at least give people that option, give people the tool to diagnose their own fighters. And so I usually emphasize it on managers and trainers first, because they know more than anyone what that fighter believes are their strengths and weaknesses. And sometimes there is a disconnect. And a lot of times I will hear that from a coach or a manager and be like, you know, this guy thinks he's, you know, he can go in there and stand and trade with this other opponent. And, you know, I'm worried about that. Say, okay, well, let's look at the data and see how he stacks up. And maybe we do identify a specific weakness. And maybe that was at the root of the concern, which is maybe his strike defense is poor. So when he does get into these wars, he gets beat up a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, the fighter himself thinks he's invincible. And that's, you know, most people don't worry about defense first. They worry about offense. But the true professionals will worry about that defense. They will find that hole in their game and they will fix it. So I've definitely seen some trainers really latch onto this stuff. They are using it in its proper intended way, which is, let's evaluate my guys. Let's be very honest and open about what the numbers are telling us. If there is an outlier here and there, you know, there was an off fight, maybe our guy was injured that fight, so we see a down metric, that's fine, move on. But this is an extra resource that is available to them that is very rich. And it's also, in a macro sense, it's somewhat agnostic, in that, you know, you can't argue with getting knocked out or having poor takedown offense. You know, it's pointing out that this is how you performed, and you might think that you're better than that number, but the reality is that the number reflects what actually happened. So, it has to be used in context, has to be used with people that are very intimately familiar with a particular fighter or the situation. But it is an incredibly valuable resource, and it's interesting to see some very successful coaches, are the ones that are being the first to adopt this.
So you are obviously an author of the book, Fightnomics. We talked about, obviously on Twitter, pretty active there, sharing more, you know, general data and so on, doing appearances and what have you. But are you also, so it sounds like you're also coaching, not, I wouldn't say coaching, but advising camps and fighters. Is this kind of just one-off stuff? Is it regular gigs, or how does that work with you?
Yeah, so I used to be formally associated with a management group. At the time, it was helmed by MC Hammer, so he was involved.
Oh, Alchemist, right?
Yeah, so this is Alchemist, and they launched, they had, I think at the peak, nearly 30 fighters that we were managing. And I was the special advisor to the company, but also to the whoever they managed and whatever matchups were coming up. I was also providing statistical consultation to whatever coaches wanted it. And again, some coaches it wanted a lot more than others. Some fighters wanted it a lot more than others. Some fighters would be chomping at the bit. I would know who their opponent was weeks before it was announced. And how soon can we have a conference call with all my coaches and go through what you found so that we can watch the tape and figure out, you know, our future game plan. And those were obviously my favorite guys. I put tons of work into that. There were other guys that really didn't read this stuff. They might hand it off to their coaches. Their coaches may or may not have fully embraced it. So there's obviously a wide variance in terms of adoption. Since then, since Alchemist isn't really active anymore, I do a lot of consultations for either legacy clients, people that I worked with a while back, and pop up every now and then when there's a key matchup. And then I do have some individual clients that kind of came to me through mutual acquaintances and said, I'm working with these few athletes and I would like to pay for statistical reports. And yeah, this is, here's our matchup, go for it. So I try to limit myself. I've landed in Silicon Valley and I do have a day job that is fairly intensive in the startup world. Mm-hmm. So I've toned back the full-time analysis, but I'm also very passionate about the sport. So it's pretty hard to put this down. It's, you know, it's also a hobby, but it's, you know, it's something that it's like an expensive professional hobby. So I'm still pretty active. And I just have to manage my client list based on, you know, who wants it most usually.
Well, I tell you what, you're preaching to the choir. Same thing with me. I work for a startup on the East Coast, tech-based startup. And MMA stuff is a nice little side gig. So yeah, I know exactly what you mean. It's tough when like you're staring at things for your day job and you're just like, oh, this other stuff is kind of so interesting, but I got to go with who's paying me the most money. So it is it's a tough balance these days. And I mean, in a lot of ways, people talk about pioneers, you know, you're a pioneer in this analytics evaluation, this era, kind of bring it in. I mean, do you think of yourself in that way? Have you had other people tell you that? It just seems that there's not too many people talking about this with the passion and intensity that you do.
At the time, you know, the reason I went into it was because it was just an underserved market. I was transitioning between consulting firms at the time, actually, after grad school. I went to an MMA event. I was with some friends who were sponsors and got to know UFC executives, athletes, and I started asking questions, which comes naturally for a consultant. And no one had any good answers. And I said, you know, why don't you guys look at this? This is actually potentially important. And they said, okay, smart guy, go figure it out. And literally a producer in the back of a taxi cab said that to me one time. He's like, hey, go online, get some data, and if you can prove it to me, we'll talk. And so that turned into a different relationship. I actually created some analytical tools for them. But it also caused me to find Fightmetric. And it was just right place, right time. I saw an opportunity. I saw these guys had a ton of data. They hadn't done anything with it yet. And they were looking for ways to roll this out. And so, it was a nascent market. And that's part of the reason why I got involved. But then I think growing through the full Alchemist process, getting to see all the different aspects of the business, where do people fit? There just wasn't enough room for a guy like me. This is not an NFL organization or an NBA, even an NHL or soccer team at this point is using some analytics and they probably have some in-house capabilities and people like me. But the UFC wasn't there and fight camps weren't quite there yet either. So yeah, I would have to keep this as more of a side hobby for a while until maybe the sport got big enough, agree to be kind of an outsider, and which is what I'm doing now. I participate in the sport as a third party. I'm an advisor. I get called in for special projects, sometimes it's salary negotiations. But it's fun for me. But I also understand that it's not quite big enough to be a full-time thing. So I'm okay having opened the door, and hopefully a lot more people get involved, and hopefully the sport grows to the point where this is a real need. And in the meantime, I'll just kind of ride along in the sidecar.
Well, you know, I do know a certain organization that's building a very large facility in Las Vegas, and I know that they are, getting into a lot of athlete performance and trying to build this whole thing in internally. And I imagine, this organization, UFC, I think it is, they must have a corner office, nice view of the strip, and some money set aside for someone of your ilk at some point. So maybe that'll come up at some point, but I can definitely see them hopefully doing that angle at some point. Let's kind of go into your process and specifically for this weekend coming up. We have a big event. Obviously, there's a lot of fighters on the card. How do you start preparing, or when did you start preparing for UFC 198, and what's your process like?
There's actually a few different work streams that go on. I will stick to what is more public facing, and I'll glaze over some of the stuff that we reserve for the premium, either clients or other activities in terms of prediction. So most of what we're publishing externally is going to be essentially benchmarks. So performance metrics for every single fighter. And that has to be refreshed after fighters fight. So, you know, my stats today for Fabricio Werdum is going to change, obviously, after the course of this weekend. Maybe not as much as a younger fighter who only has 20 minutes of sample size might change a lot more. So keeping up with the activity is primarily the workload. We've already created these performance metrics and organized them and tried to create frameworks to present them in a meaningful way that are easy to digest in terms of our Uber tail of the tape, where we actually list out the metrics head to head versus some of our graphs that we pump out that are, you know, a single performance metric and a lot of different fighters on that metric. So, the process really starts with the data. We update the data, we refresh all of our performance metrics. And then for each event, we start pairing guys up and create some output, whether it's Uber tail of the tape or if we highlight a particular theme. You know, this week is a pay-per-view event, so we're racking and stacking most of the fighters on the card in terms of striking metrics, which is what most people like to look at, as well as overall effectiveness, which is a fight metric term in terms of significant strikes. It's a phrase that we throw around that has a very particular meaning. And so, yeah, it started a while back, but in terms of focusing on each event, it's sort of a weekly cycle.
So in my open, I didn't even mention that you've been doing some work for ESPN and ESPN's Insider. And how did that arrangement work out, or begin rather?
I think it was a conference. Someone from ESPN's team reached out and said, "Hey, you know, we've been monitoring your work for a while and we'd like to get involved." It's just, I think at the time there was still this question mark as to whether or not ESPN would really embrace MMA as a sport. Once the UFC kind of did the Fox deal and hired off a lot of the MMA Alive analysts, the Kenny Florians, the John Anik of the world, they were all ESPN people and they ended up over on Fox. So there was still there was a big question mark over whether or not ESPN was really going to go in. But I think eventually they realized, hey, this is going to be a big deal. This is a huge combat sport. If we're even going to remotely cover boxing, we got to cover MMA. And so it's not a huge part of their content, but they reached out and we tried to come up with a few different frameworks on content that we could do for ESPN that was recurring. And right now it's mostly ESPN Insider / Chalk, which is their betting site. But I do a preview for the pay-per-view cards every month. And then last year I was doing every week, appearing on MMA Live, just doing a single fight breakdown. And I don't do that anymore. I'm considering maybe, throwing my hat in the ring again. We'll see now that my schedule is calming down a little bit. But yeah, it keeps me involved. And, the ESPN, obviously, I mean, consummate professionals, excellent team there. They have pretty impressive in-house capabilities on their stats and analytics group to begin with. So they already have good information. So it's just a question of packaging it in a way that fans can actually enjoy it and digest it and take something from it.
Do you find that more and more fans, as this, as analytics gets to be more mainstream? I mean, it already is, but gets to be more understood. Do you find that you get less and less questions, or do you get more and more questions on more specifics that maybe years ago people wouldn't have understood?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think both are true. So I used to get a lot of questions just about even using the term significant strike. And it's actually funny, when I first talked with ESPN, they said, yeah, we have this whole part of our website. We have player or fighter profiles and metrics and everything. Go check it out. And I'm not sure how long it had been there, but every row down the line where it was supposed to say significant strike, it said signature strike, which was probably a typo when they created it. I'm not sure how long it had been sitting there, but no one had ever pointed it out. Maybe Fight Metric had pointed out, but I basically went back to them and said, "Hey, this is completely wrong. You know, your variables don't even sync up with what we're seeing on television and what we're seeing on the Fight Metric website. Like, you gotta clean this up." And they did. I think they finally, maybe my complaint was the straw that broke the camel's back, and they finally fixed it. But yeah, that the significant strike has always been a question mark for a lot of people, because there wasn't a formal definition that gets floated around a lot. So there's actually a chapter in the book where I create a very extensive graphic explaining exactly what is and is not a significant strike. And then we benchmark those in terms of accuracy, rates, all the different ways you could slice and dice that. So that used to be one of the most common questions I got. And now you're right. It's more nuanced stuff. What goes into the total takedown success rate? I will usually break that out by type if I'm doing a consultation, because I think there's a big difference in how people attempt takedowns and what the success rates are. How to interpret a significant strike is even that is a rolled up metric. I mean, that was an attempt to get a single number that was overall informative. But the problem with that is that it rolls up a lot of detail, and it can actually be skewed and misleading in certain circumstances, because if a fighter tends to be more of a stand-up fighter versus a ground fighter, you're going to see different success rates and different overall rates. So even that number can be misleading sometimes when you try to compare two people. So yeah, the audience has learned to digest these things. Every week we're seeing stats on UFC Tonight, on live broadcasts, and we're even starting to see some of the first motion capture data. So it was last year that Fightmetric implemented motion capture sensors in the rings to capture where each fighter is and for how long. So you essentially get a heat map. And we've only seen it on TV a few times, but this is data that they only just started capturing once they got it hooked up. It's not something they could retroactively go back in time and just rewatch tape and collect data, which is how they actually got all their discrete metrics. But the motion capture stuff is really cool. You really get to see where the heat map of a fight takes place, whether it is two guys toe-to-toe. Like if you look at John McDessity and Donald Cerrone, when those two guys fought, they were in the center of the cage slinging leather at each other. And that is a very different blueprint than a fight that occurs all over or specifically against the fence. Yeah. And that's just an extra level of detail that we're just starting to see, and it's going to open a door to all sorts of different analysis.
Is there, for those listening that are kind of dipping their toe in the trying to understand this from a fan's perspective, what would you direct them towards? Is it a specific maybe, what is there a specific stat or mindset or what would you point them toward to help them kind of understand without overwhelming them to start with?
I guess that's a tough question because what you're seeing, what's most readily available is typically significant strike metrics and takedown metrics. It used to be that really all you knew about a fight was who won, how, and how long it took. So was it a knockout or a submission or a decision? And if it ended early, how long did it take? And that's basically all you knew. Mm-hmm. So now you know how many strikes were delivered, how many takedowns were landed. And you also, if you go online and go to Fightmetric, they will show you the box score. And the box score was an attempt to encapsulate an entire fight into a bite-sized piece of information that could be thrown onto a newspaper just like a baseball box score. It had basically the most important things that happened. You don't get to feel how the fight went down. But you can probably tell that if there are a lot of takedowns by one fighter and a lopsided significant strike total, I kind of have some sense of how this fight went, especially if it ended up in a submission or something. But if two guys went toe-to-toe back and forth and it was a wild slobber knocker, it's hard to tell that on paper other than seeing high volumes. But when you look at a raw number like that, how do you know if it's truly a high volume? How do I know that 50 strikes landed in a fight is high or low without also seeing several other box scores where one of them had 100 mm-hmm. landed in a single fight. So you got to start high level and work your way down. And I think the best way, and this is true in a lot of ways on how you learn about something, is carve out one piece that makes some sense and understand it more fully, and then you expand the aperture on that and roll it out to a few adjacent pieces. So if you have a wrestling background, understanding takedowns and what is normal for takedown success, how often it leads to submission attempts, things like that, that's pretty interesting. Whereas the strikers, it's all about power, accuracy, pace, and then ultimately defense, which is the reverse of several of those metrics. So the way we've done the Uber tail of the tape is to go from that macro view of here's a guy, he's won a bunch of fights by knockout, to much more detail in terms of what is his actual knockdown rate. Is it because he's very accurate or just powerful? Is he a reserved counter striker or is he aggressive in beating people up? How is his defense? Is he also at risk? Even if he's won a lot of fights by knockout, maybe he's also a liability to be knocked out. That's the level of detail we can get into with more metrics, detailed metrics in the Uber tail of the tape versus just a box score or just some career, how many wins, how many knockouts. And we're getting there. And I think more and more people are understanding this stuff.
Before we take a look ahead for this weekend, was there anything coming off of last weekend that really surprised you with that show in Rotterdam? Obviously, a lot of finishes, a lot of stoppages, some fun action. Obviously, with heavyweights, things get a little unpredictable. But was there anything that coming out of that card that was like, you know, for you that really stood out as, wow, I did not expect that? Or was everything right in line with what you thought?
A lot of it was right in line with what I thought, okay. especially the last two fights, which I paid the most attention to just because of sample size, really, because I need sample size on both guys to really understand what I think is going to happen. But in both those cases, it really played out. Heavyweights are both volatile because of how much power they have and how easily a fight can end with one shot. But for some reason, I also feel like they're almost more predictable in that way because I see patterns of who has power and precision and what is the nature of their opponent in terms of aggression and how susceptible are they. So the Stefan Struve and Silva matchup played out almost like an accelerated version of what I was hoping for, best case scenario. And Stefan happens to be a former client of mine and he's an awesome, awesome dude. So I was really happy to see him pull that off.
Yeah.
And expecting to see him pull that off. And then Overeem and Arlovsky was kind of a toss up for a lot of people. You know, everybody's heart was with Arlovsky. Everybody's head was with Overeem. But when you look specifically at the paper, you realize, you know, Arlovsky is very aggressive. Overeem is extremely reserved. He's also the most accurate puncher in the entire heavyweight division. So allowing him to move backwards while Arlovsky comes forward just played right into Overeem's game. And that's exactly what happened. And that was on paper. It was the blueprint that was there for how this fight would go. It was, you know, Overeem's going to probably lose on a round-to-round basis, but he only needs to find that one opening. And the more Arlovsky pushes forward, the more Overeem is going to have that chance to do that. And he is one of the best in the business at finding your head. His accuracy is just bonkers. So that really did play right as we expected. So that was the big takeaway from that fight card is that even though heavyweights are volatile, those particular two matchups just played right to the way they should have on paper.
That's always a good thing, right? When the numbers actually when the actual result backs up the numbers, that's a good thing. Looking ahead to this weekend, obviously with your insider stuff coming up, there's some certain things you can't reveal, but tell me some, you sent me some images, I know you've tweeted some stuff out as well. Talk about kind of some things that you're noticing about this weekend for a big show in Brazil, even though Anderson Silva's not on the card anymore. Still a lot of interesting fights, still a lot of fun fights. What are you looking at for this weekend?
Yeah, I mean, the amount of star power on this card is kind of nuts, and I feel like we've just been distracted by several of these other events, especially with the Conor McGregor stuff going on. You know, it's funny how many requests I get for information on Conor McGregor compared to anyone else, really. First it was Ronda Rousey, then it was Conor McGregor. But here we are. We have this card that just slipped right under the radar, and it's a nuts card. And so I think it's really interesting. Several of the matchups are massive stylistic mismatches. And that stuff comes out very clearly on paper. So to see like a Demian Maia versus a Matt Brown, they have completely different profiles in terms of where they excel and don't. And then watching a fight like that is a very different experience than watching two fighters who are very similar and how that might play out. And it becomes a game of, you know, who's going to land first or Anderson Silva and Uriah Hall actually had that feel to it. You know, these are two precise, powerful strikers that are pretty diverse in their attacks, and yet they're also really reserved. Like they really wait and wait and wait, and you wish they would pull the trigger, but they're waiting. And so those two guys, it was going to be a staring match until something happened, and then it was a question of who lands first. Now, that fight has been canceled. We don't know if Hall is going to get a replacement or not, but that fight is going to have an extremely different feel than Demian Maia and Matt Brown, where you have one of the best grapplers, arguably the best around, certainly at welterweight, in Demian Maia, and he's taken on a guy who is famous for being a brawler, but he's a really good brawler, and he actually has decent takedown defense, Matt Brown. So that fight could be kind of a stalemate, and where each guy is afraid to engage the other one in their strength. Mm-hmm. And then, so I could keep going, but the point is that when I look at these numbers, I see some storylines that are beginning to play out. And it's not always just let the best man win or who lands the first punch. There are stylistic things that do reveal themselves in the numbers, and they become interesting as a storyline when you watch a fight. Because not every fight is going to be a barn burner and just two guys punching it out. And if it is a boring fight, like, well, maybe it's not boring if you're a true fan of the sport and you can appreciate grappling, but a lot of people get hung up on that. And when it comes to the wrestling, if two guys are really struggling for position, that can be a very interesting chess match. You know, Jake Shields versus Demian Maia was a classic, American jiu-jitsu versus Brazilian jiu-jitsu, so to speak. And was it a barn burner? No, it was five rounds of basically a grappling match, but it was extremely detailed and it was a chess match. So, that's some of the things I like to look for when I'm trying to see which fights I'm going to be paying the most attention to.
One of these things is not like the other, that being the, as you said, that being the odds for the Cyborg Justino versus Leslie Smith fight. Obviously, people can look at the odds and so on, but this is pretty big. A Justino as big as a 1700 favorite by the time you did the screenshot off Best Fight Odds. This is, I guess, for five dimes anyway, as high as a 2300 favorite one of the other sites there. Interesting stuff that, I mean, no big surprise, I guess, from just reputation that she's such a big favorite, but do you think that's too big?
Yeah, you know, I would say that there's always a puncher's chance, and what that really means is that there's always some volatility in terms of who might be having a bad weight cut, who might be sick, who might be injured, who might twist their ankle on the way to the cage. Granted, those are low probability events, but right based on the current odds, I mean, we're getting to the point where they're only giving her opponent, you know, less than a 5% chance of winning in some markets. So that's kind of crazy. Now, if I look at the performance metrics, and this isn't great apples to apples comparison because the only metrics we have for Cyborg are her Strikeforce fights, which were at featherweight. But her numbers are kind of ridiculous. I mean, I didn't even bother putting an Uber tape together because it just would have been check marks all the way down on one side of the page. Mm-hmm. And her opponent only has a small sample size. So, and she has some actually poor metrics. So on paper, if I didn't have some additional context to this, I would say this is one of the most extreme matchups I've seen, lopsided. But at the same time, I know this is the UFC. You don't get to be there. Leslie Smith is a skilled enough fighter. Obviously, she's a deserving underdog here, and the numbers are a little bit worrisome because of her. I guess one thing that leaps off the page that I'm seeing is actually her head strike defense is quite poor, and Cyborg is actually a very good striker. So that's a mismatch right there. But is it 20 to 1? Is it 50 to 1? Is it 10 to 1? Yeah. You start to get into these edge cases where other things could become more meaningful than the matchup itself.
So, Reed, you've been very generous with your time, and I want to give you a few minutes here to plug where people can read you this weekend. Obviously, I mentioned ESPN Insider, but the book, other stuff, the floor is yours. Tell people how they can connect and interact with you and help pay your salaries, I guess. help pad things a little bit, rather, with some extra spending money, put it that way.
Yeah, so the book is out there. It is available on Amazon as well as eBay, Fightnomics. Just look it up or go to Fightnomics.com is our main website. When I do previews for major cards, it's pay-per-view cards always for ESPN. Also sometimes for the Washington Post, we'll pick one matchup to highlight at their Fancy Stats blog. MMA Oddsbreaker is a site that I contribute to routinely. So even for non-pay-per-view events, I might do some matchup breakdowns. Basically, if I ever do a non-pay-per-view event matchup breakdown, it's going to be at MMAoddsbreaker.com. And they are a site dedicated to analyzing MMA specifically and then also looking at the betting angles, which most people are usually interested in, especially with the rise of fantasy sports. So I may be contributing to a few other places. We haven't determined yet. But if most importantly, if you're interested in the book, this will get you up to speed on what types of metrics are available. It goes through all the averages and trends and weight classes and looks at some of the big questions. And then on an ongoing basis, we're always looking to improve what we share and the granularity, the detail of the metrics that we're putting out to the market. So hopefully there's an increasing appetite for this stuff. And if there is, we'll keep cranking it out.
I don't think you'll have any issue with that. I think this is just going to be a bigger thing as time goes forward. As fans understand a little bit more about what these mean and can understand and transfer it into their own knowledge, and again, what aspect the fans are willing to accept it, and I think they will based on what we've seen other sports. Before I forget, have you ever spoken at the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference?
Yes. I have done that a few years back, and I do believe that lecture is on their website somewhere. And it may be on Fightnomics.com somewhere. I think I posted the link.
Excellent. We'll hopefully get to speak there again. Reed Kuhn from Fightnomics, thanks so much for joining Josh Nason's Punch Out this week. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you. Enjoy the fights.
Well, I hope you guys enjoyed that. As I clumsily try to discuss during the talk, I think the UFC is stupid if they don't hire this guy. I mean, seriously, if they're developing this athlete performance center and they are all that money invested in that brand new facility that they're doing, and really if they're trying to restructure how their fighters train, prepare, get ready, all this, analytics has to be a huge part of that. And why not go get the guy that's the preeminent expert right now? Maybe they're already talking. I'm not sure. But I think my prediction is I think Reed's going to end up with a pretty sweet job in MMA analytics at some point, sooner or another, hopefully with UFC, because I definitely think they could use his services if he's willing to go there. We're not really sure. So again, big thanks to Reed Kuhn. That was an awesome talk. And we got to talk a little bit about the card coming up, and obviously you can hear about more about what he's thinking about that. Couldn't reveal everything, being the paid content end of ESPN Insider. Know how that is here. But the show overall, it looks fun. It's a bummer that Anderson Silva is not on the card anymore. I think that was going to be an interesting fight against Uriah Hall. But there's plenty of other talent on that show between the main event with Fabricio Werdum against Stipe Miocic. I think the atmosphere is going to be really cool as well. Co-main event, Jacare versus Vitor Belfort. And the debut of Cyborg Justino on that show. Damian Maia taking on Matt Brown, which it looks like that will probably, I haven't looked recently, Uriah Hall is definitely off that card now. My assumption is that Brown and Maia is going to get called up to the main show, but I'm not really sure about that as we speak right now on Wednesday night. But overall, I mean, up and down that card, there's a lot of fun fights. So definitely, no Silva, no problem. Get the show. Be confident knowing that you're going to get your money's worth on Saturday night. And let's see, UFC Rotterdam last weekend. That was another fun show. My apologies for not doing a podcast last week. I had a guest lined up, all set to go. And then for some reason, the good Lord decided to give me the flu for about 48 hours or so. That was no fun. I could talk, but I was so stuffed up and was hacking and was absolute misery midweek, right as I was about to record. So our guest is going to be joining us here in a couple weeks. So what's really cool is that sometimes when this stuff happens, I end up getting guests lined up week after week after week. So I think we're going to be good here for another run of about maybe 2 months or so with some new stuff, hopefully leading right into UFC 200. And yeah, that's coming up in July. That's a fun show. I think I'm kind of over my stuff I've talked about in previous months with previous weeks with being really kind of disappointed with the card, not really having any big star on the show, just not feeling UFC 200-like. at this point, looking at that show from top to bottom, it's pretty dumb to get upset about it. So I'm on board. I'm on board UFC 200, 198, 199. It's going to be a fun couple months. I'm really interested to see, as all of you are, where all this business talk with selling shares or selling the company, all this happens as we sit right now. Again, by the time that you listen to this in the morning, things could have completely changed. So know that I'm recording this or finishing this up on Wednesday night, that the expansion and understanding UFC's business plans and all that, of course, they don't have to make this stuff public. However, it does lead to a lot of speculation. Dan Revell, I know a lot of people have issues with him on Twitter and his personality, whatever. He definitely knows his shit. So to say that there's no truth to it absolutely is one thing. But as you heard Dana White talk about today, there's definitely some they're not denying that there may be something going on with some sort of investment in the company from outside interests. They did this before with Flash Entertainment to get more of a hold perhaps in the Middle East, and then maybe with an idea of going to Asia. Maybe that didn't work as they expected, and now they're maybe looking to expand further out into China and make themselves the preeminent fighting organization there and kind of start seeding that country now with those fancy three letters UFC. And perhaps this is a way to do that, but it could be part of a bigger deal. Something big is going on, and a very interesting and very newsworthy and incredible 2016 continues to roll on. So for people like myself and like you, it's a fun year. With all that said, I'm going to let you guys go. I will, couple quick notes. Civil War, if you have not seen that, if you're a Marvel fan, I can't believe you haven't seen it yet. That movie's awesome. Saw it 2 times in 4 days, just happened to turn out. It was great both times. Awesome stuff. And it's cool finding some of the, looking at some of the videos online afterwards, Easter eggs you might have not picked up and all these other kind of little things. And again, make sure you stay all the way through the credits. Game of Thrones, that's been awesome. No spoilers here. Do some good things for your fellow man and don't spoil anything for them, especially in, say, the 24 hours after the show, as many people may not get a chance to watch it live. There are a few that's still left there out there. That's about it. That's all the pop culture and stuff I can give you for this time. Again, big thanks to Reed Kuhn. Thanks to all you guys for listening. Share the show around, and we'll talk to you next week. Until next time, insert catchphrase here.